Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday morning. It is the 28th of September. Very nice to have you with us. 12 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. As Ray mentioned and I mentioned during the billboard, we have a lot of panelists today, and we are thrilled because they all are great and have a lot to say, and we want to get to all of them, so we'll get right to that. We also welcome your letters, of course. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Hello. I must say I'm not happy about being called a clown by Ray Graff.
I don't know. He said a clown car. Yeah, I don't
well,
know.
Well, who do you think was in that clown car? We were in it. I love Ray Graff. I think you should take it up with Ray.
Yeah. Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld is here. Good morning, sir.
Very nice to be with you. I thought that my arm hurts a little bit because one of those big clown shoes stepped on it. So yeah. That can happen when you get out of
That's
the clown
actually my
car.
Normal shoe.
Oh,
yeah. Hey, Ira, you got in that clown car?
I got in. There was no room for anybody else besides me.
Here we go. Professor of Political Science at Siena College, Vera Akarios-Kelly. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much to have you here. Communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois is with us. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. Back again.
And in a few moments, at about 9:30, we have been talking a lot this week, as we have last week, about the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico and the storm damage and the desperate situation that those localities are in. We're going to be joined by Professor Marisol Lebron, who teaches American Studies at Dickinson College and is co-founder of the Puerto Rican Syllabus Project and is doing a lot of good work, and we will be talking to her coming up right after our 9:30 newscast. So we will get to that in just a moment. Again, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us go to what is happening in the news and try to dissect, and I guess we will start with, as we should, we will start with the tax cut plan and try to figure out exactly what is happening. President Trump's Washington, the budget deficit for this fiscal year is expected to be near $700 billion, and the federal debt has topped $20 trillion. A new tax cut is emerging to rival those of the Bush years, and the deficit hawks have hardly peeped, according to this article in the New York Times. The plan was released yesterday and adds quite a bit to our deficit, a lot of tax cuts, but also not a lot of relief for the middle class. Donald Trump calling this the most sweeping tax overhaul in decades. Here's just a word. Plan to slash taxes and salvage what remains. It's proposing a array of tax cuts for individuals and businesses that would constitute, as I said, this most sweeping changes in the federal code. He calls it a revolutionary change, and saying that it is an economic imperative, a fulfillment of a promise to his working class supporters to deliver benefits in the form of lower taxes, better jobs, and higher wages. Here's the problem. No measure of the plan's cost, scant detail about how working people would benefit from a proposal that has explicit and substantial rewards for wealthy people and corporations, including the elimination of taxes on large inheritances, deep reductions in the rates paid by businesses, large and small, and a lot of secret talks among Republicans. A 9-page proposal produced by the so-called Big Six Working Group, as the paper says, and most pundits are saying, prompts as many questions as it provides answers. Alan.
Well, there are a couple of premises here. Premise number one is, how are you going to pay for it? You've just suggested that. We knew that they were after the health care money so that they could put that towards paying for the tax cuts. Now they can't do it, so they're falling back on the usual nonsense, which is we'll go from 1-point-something% to 3% every year in terms of the American economy rise, and that's what's going to save us all. It's baloney. It's not going to happen, and therefore, they're saying it. Now, what they're relying on here is greed, that the American people are saying, I don't like paying taxes. No, who does? I don't love it. Nevertheless, they're trying to give something to everybody without telling you exactly what's going to happen. Nurse Carol writes to us a lot, and we love her. She's a great volunteer and everything else. And she says, will you explain what the K, when you keep referring to K Street, what you're referring to? Okay, I'm talking about K Street, meaning all those lobbyists who work on K Street and who come out, and each of them is hired to get a different deduction to so that some industry or some person will make out like a bandit. Those people are not going to crawl into a hole somewhere and go away. And those are the people who make sure that our politicians, shall I say it this way, are bought and paid for, meaning that they get campaign money for doing what the lobbyists ask them to do. So this is really a mess. And then the last thing is, they're still not saying what the people at the top are going to get. Teresa?
So Lily Batchelder, who is with Obama, she was the deputy director for his National Economic Council. I thought that her quote was the best overview. She said, in broad brush strokes, they're doing nothing for the bottom 35%, very little, possibly raising taxes on the middle class, and very specified tax cuts for the wealthy. And the, as you say, the big issue is how to pay for it, because they don't have the health care savings. And so what they'll do is run up the deficits. And then once you run up the deficits, you have to figure out a way to pay for that. And so then they'll say, when the deficits are soaring, well, we're going to have to cut further back on programs, cut Medicaid, cut Social Security, because they've cut most everything else to the bone. So, you know, I think that the other thing that Trump is very consistent on is they're and the Republicans, they're talking about this in the same way they talked about repeal and replace. Broad strokes, not a lot of content, saying how good it's going to be for the working class, when in fact the details that are available don't support that whatsoever.
Yeah, so I wanted to just mention also the fact that estimates suggest that the corporate tax rate shift to 35% will likely reduce the national income in terms of a tax base by $1.5 billion in the coming decade, which obviously will create all kinds of problems covering expenses on social services, educational opportunities, and programs that are usually you know, supported in some way or another. So the future, I think, looks bleak if this kind of a program is really, you know, going beyond a framework. My worry is that most people are beginning to tune out because, as you know, it gets more and more complicated. The healthcare issue, now the tax, people are possibly getting a little tired of trying to figure out all these details and, you know, what Trump is really trying to achieve. And all he says is, we'll create jobs, jobs, jobs. And perhaps people still have hope that the tax plan will achieve that.
I'm also, and Ira, I wanted you to chime in on this, but I while I was watching that announcement yesterday, you kind of go through the whole thing. And you try to hang on to find some detail or to kind of understand. And then he turns around and says, oh, by the way, we have the votes for health care. We're fine. We're good. We had the votes. If the one guy wasn't in the hospital, which he wasn't, but if he was, but he's in the hospital, and otherwise we had the votes. And then, and doesn't that like sort of put the credibility to the test on everything he said prior to that?
You think? I mean,
it just didn't make any sense.
Yeah, I always feel the need to begin with a disclaimer when I talk about Trump, and that is, I don't believe a word of what the man says. So even if he told me tomorrow was Friday, I'd ask to see the calendar just to be sure. So there's that. And secondly, and you all have used the word details several times. This reminds me of when I was writing editorials, and every year, whether it was the governor's proposed budget or any budget plan like that. We would write about it dutifully and discuss some of the things that he mentioned in the budget presentation. I'm sorry, not the budget, the State of the Union, or the State of the State. And then at the end, virtually all of the time, the editorial will end by saying the devil is in the details. We don't really know a lot of what this is all about. It's been, I believe the New York Times suggested that it would be a $2 trillion hit on the a shortfall by cutting taxes. They'd have to find $2 trillion somewhere else. They also suggested that the two major areas where people who have money would benefit is in the estate tax and the alternate minimum tax, and the latter is supposedly Trump pays, and of course we don't know because he's not released his tax returns, $31 million a year, that if that could get wiped off of his tax obligation.
Well, we do know that one because of one tax document that did come out. That's why people know the $31 million, yeah, because of 1 year of taxes. One part of 1 year of taxes showed that he would benefit from
that. But to the point of people being tired of it, I don't think there's any question that people are tired of it, but I do think there's a big question as to how many people are paying attention. And the people who are probably paying the least attention are the people who are going to be disproportionately hurt by a plan.
Right, because their claimed theory is that they will lower the corporate tax rate, they will make all these changes, and then there'll be so much growth that it will make up for the loss in revenue coming in. But I don't know that there's any economist who shows that that's true. I mean, over and over again, the economists say you can't get the kind of growth they claim. But let's look at just the estate tax claim yesterday. In his event, he referenced and noted, well, there's a person in the audience, his name was Kip Thom, he was a farmer from Indiana, and he talked about how important this was to people like Kip Thom, that the estate tax really cripples farmers. Well, it turns out, he is a farmer, Kip Thom, but he also gets $3.3 million in farm subsidies. He has much more than a farm. He also has a grain storage and other business. And he will not, in fact, be, by all accounts, be hurt by this. And the estate tax, they always point to it hurting farmers. But in fact, there's very little evidence that that's the case. There's a group called Responsible Wealth. These are a group of very well-to-do people who argue against cutting the estate tax, and have documented how, in fact, it even though they have to pay, it benefits them because the funding goes to training and so on and so forth.
But do you think, Alan and Teresa and Beard, do you think that, unlike the health plan, which divided the Republicans, yep, in the Senate, don't you think that this tax plan, whatever it winds up being, is more likely to succeed in the Congress?
Absolutely. Absolutely correct, Ira. Look, here's what happens. In the health care plan, a lot of people recognize that 23 million Americans or 25 million Americans were going to lose their health care. That was not a good thing. And people could understand that. It was simple. It was easy to understand. Now, in the tax cut, believe me, when you were talking about people couldn't figure out where it was, or Vera said it, where we're going with all of this, because they couldn't make heads or tails of it. The only thing they're looking at is, what does it mean to me? I mean, what person really doesn't want their kids to be able to inherit their money without the estate taxes that go with it? I understand it. I'm making the argument there should be an estate tax. Nevertheless, I'm telling you, people are looking at this. The AMT, I can't tell you every time I go to the accountant at the end of the year, they said, well, you barely qualify, but you qualify for the AMT. Therefore, it's going to cost you even more money. These are things that individuals understand. And Ira, I think you're right. I think this, based on that, will pass. And they don't really care. People don't really care that there really isn't the money that's needed to pay for it without the deficit. So the deficit goes up, they're saying.
Vera?
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think that's what's coming. I think most of the people that are going to be hit by, then the bottom income level, I think that tax rate is supposed to go from 10% to 12%. are those the voters and the individuals paying attention at this point? They're just hearing, I'm going to pay less, this might create jobs. And I think overall, this is probably an area where we see progress for the Republican Party. I mean, they will push this through, I think.
The only thing that could slow it down is if in hearings or wherever in the lead up to the vote, and if that $2 trillion shortfall is accurate, if they have to start explaining where how they're going to fill that $2 trillion. Is it $2 trillion that they're just never going to spend again? And if so, where is that coming from? Or what is going to be cut? That would seem to me to be the equivalent to what Alan was talking about, the 23 million people who would be without health care.
Yeah.
What do you mean? We're going to do tax cuts and this is going to be eliminated? No, we don't want that eliminated.
Hey, Ira, the New York Times editorial board and the Washington Post editorial board may be saying that again and again and again. But I'm going back to what I said before. I think Vera agreed with me, which is that most Americans don't get into that level. What they do is they say, is this particular bill good for me or bad for me? And they don't recognize that in the end, if things get out of control, it's bad for them. They never get that.
But do you think that there are members of Congress who represent them? And whose job it is to look at the details of those are going to do that? Do you think the people, the members of Congress on the far right who say that they're fiscal conservatives are going to say, okay, yeah, we will vote for this. It's going to add $1 trillion to the deficit.
Hey, wait. Teresa, this morning, Mark Meadows was on the television, you know, the head of the Freedom Caucus. I think that's his name.
Yes.
Talking about how they're on board. They're already on board with the whole thing. So that's your Freedom Caucus. Give us a tax break. We'll worry about the details later. And by the way, I don't think members of Congress have ever been known for their tremendous understanding or courage in all of this.
And Ira talks about hearings. Well, you know, when the last time they keep saying, well, the last time they did this was in 1986. Well, when the last big tax change, first of all, the administration provided a detailed analysis, economic analysis, and then there were over a year of hearings. And they say that they're going to do this in the next couple of weeks. And
of course.
At the same time, remember how much they kicked down the road. You know, they kicked down the with the Trump-Schumer-Pelosi budget agreement, they moved everything into December. They're less than 40 days now before the end of the year. And they're going to do major tax reform. They're going to do the budget. They're going to raise the debt limit.
We have to take a break. So let's pause there. When we come back, we are going to talk. We are going to talk to Professor Marisol LeBron about the situation in Puerto Rico. We have a lot of letters on taxes and Puerto Rico. We'll talk about all of that when we come back. We're going to go to a news break, and we welcome your letters, of course. Panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. We have Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld. Yeah, it's Fussfeld now,
same,
isn't it?
Still.
Yes. Thank you. Vera and Teresa will be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, listening to the music of Annie Cordero, who is going to be playing at Mass Mocha on October 7th. The album is Recordar, and it is she is a Brooklyn-based Puerto Rican songstress. She will be at Mass Mocha on the 7th of October. MassMocha.org for more information. We'll be hearing more music as we go through our panel discussion this morning. We want to talk about Puerto Rico, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we have a special guest with us to do that for the next few minutes. We welcome Professor Marisol LeBron, who teaches American Studies at Dickinson College and is co-founder of the Puerto Rico Syllabus Project. Professor LeBron, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Very nice to have you on the program. So as the Trump administration is rushing military hardware and personnel to Puerto Rico and Virgin Islands, it becomes increasingly clear to many that the government response to this hurricane has been slow, some even saying inadequate and overmatched by the scale of the disaster. What would you like us to know about what's going on in Puerto Rico?
Well, I think one of the biggest developments is that the Jones Act, which prohibited foreign ships from reaching Puerto Rico, Sarah Huckabee Sanders just announced that it's been lifted. It's a week too late for many people, if you ask them. If we look at the case of Texas and Florida, the Jones Act was lifted immediately in order to get aid to those areas once disaster had struck. There were requests to lift the Jones Act in order to help with aid receiving Puerto Rico, so neighboring countries in the Caribbean and Latin America could reach Puerto Rico quicker than the U.S. and give immediate aid. However, it wasn't lifted, but today's announcement is a welcome relief for many people. The waiver has only been issued for 10 days, so a lot of people are hoping that perhaps there's an extension of the waiver because this is going to be a long, slow road to recovery.
Professor, what do you make of the differential between Puerto Rico and those other ports, the American ports that you mentioned?
Yeah, I think it's, there was a survey that said that more than 50% of Americans were unaware that Puerto Ricans were also citizens. And yeah. I think that is part of what is going on with the slow response. That's not to say that Puerto Ricans only deserve aid or compassion as American citizens, but that the U.S. has a special duty and responsibility to the 3.5 million residents of Puerto Rico as citizens to really aid in a speedy and fair recovery. So I think that is definitely a huge part, is that colonial legacy and colonial present that still structures the relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico. The fact that it's a largely Spanish-speaking country, it's deeply racialized in the American imagination, and that combined with most Americans, all they know about Puerto Rico, particularly in the past couple of years, is really that it is in massive debt and that they don't want to give Puerto Rico a bailout. So I think that there is this sense that has been created by the ongoing debt crisis in Puerto Rico that any kind of aid that Puerto Rico receives now would amount to a massive government bailout rather than what would be a normative recovery, the setup of a normative recovery structure for an American territory.
Well, I know you want to be careful, but how much of this do you lay at the personal door of Donald Trump? I mean, after all, he's the guy who sets the policy. He's sitting at the top.
I mean, I think that it is telling that most of the weekend was spent arguing with professional athletes rather than discussing the catastrophe that's unfolding in Puerto Rico. And I think that tells us something about what the priorities are and what Trump perhaps believes the priorities of his base are. I think that there, however, is a lot of people with their hands in the cookie jar, so to speak, in terms of the delays regarding Puerto Rico. I think it's not a mistake that the Jones Act took so long to be waived, considering the massive transportation interests that are in the Trump administration. If we think of Elaine Chao, who is in charge of transportation and has a monetary benefit from keeping the Jones Act in place as someone with connections to the transportation sector, it's telling, right? I think there's a lot of folks in the administration who stand to benefit quite substantially from a less than adequate response in Puerto Rico, from a slower response, and from keeping certain kinds of structures in place, and particularly with the adamance that there will not be a moratorium on the debt and that is not a likely outcome.
Hmm. To what degree do you think the fact that Florida and Texas particularly are Republican states, and certainly Puerto Rico is not?
Yeah, I think that's the large conception about Puerto Rico is that, and this is the Republican concern, right? And particularly we're hearing this now after the hurricane because people are going to leave, right? I think that a lot of people are not willing to stick around we're already contemplating leaving within the context of the crisis, and now the prospect of 4 to 6 months without electricity, adequate water, with sewage in the streets, they're going to migrate to the mainland. And so I think this is a huge Republican concern because the rhetoric is that Puerto Ricans are natural Democrats, right? But what we see is actually Ricardo Rosselló, who's the current governor, is part of the conservative forces on the island, pro-statehood. He is much more aligned with Trump than other kind of political figures, if we juxtapose him to someone like Carmen Yulín, who's the mayor of San Juan. So there's this notion that there is no alignment between Puerto Rico and conservative interests, and we actually see that there is a massive kind of conservative force within Puerto Rico's political structure that, you know, is really trying to reach out to their conservative compatriots in the U.S. to get aid and are being kind of having doors shut in their face. And I think that that is a wake-up call, in a sense, for Republican and pro-statehood groups on the island who have believed in a particular parity with the U.S. that is, in this moment of crisis, not happening.
I'm fascinated.
One
last thing here. I'm fascinated because statehood is always on the table. You seem to be equating statehood and republicanism. But this Congress is never going to grant Puerto Rico statehood, are they?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, I want to be careful because I don't want to imply that there's a one-to-one equation between statehood and republicanism. However, in Puerto Rico, there is an overlap between conservative and Republican affiliations. So, you know, Puerto Rico has a kind of its own Republican Party. One of the previous governors, Luis Fortuño, was a kind of prominent member. There are other members of the current kind of administration who are also involved in that. And so there is definitely overlap between the pro-statehood party and conservative and Republican political alliances, despite the fact that they cannot vote for a Republican president, right? But I think your other question is whether statehood is likely, and we see that the U.S. has consistently taken that option off the table or paid it very minimal lip service. And so I think we saw that with the previous plebiscite. The options put forward by the Puerto Rican government were for statehood and for independence to be the only two options in the referendum, and the U.S. government mandated that the current Commonwealth had to also remain an option, despite the fact that many people are disenchanted with the current political situation. And I think that that was precisely because they knew if independence and statehood were the only two options on the table, the vote would likely swing in the direction of statehood, and they want to prevent that. Now, yeah, so I think that you know, in the aftermath of Maria and with the ongoing debt crisis, that horizon is receding and is further and further away in the rearview mirror every day.
Vera, I know this is a topic of interest and of your expertise as well.
Yeah, so Professor LeBron, I wanted to just ask and go back to the humanitarian situation in the country, because while the Jones Act has been lifted and there is additional aid, in fact, it seems that one of the real problems is distribution of aid on the island.
Right.
While the port might be open for ships now, there's really no aid going into the countryside, reaching sort of more remote towns and villages where people are in absolute desperate situations. Can you talk a little bit about what this might mean for the future of the population? We're talking about 3.4 million people. Isn't that much worse than Katrina, and aren't enough military people on the or near the island to even help within the next sort of week? It'll be a complete humanitarian disaster, from what I understand.
Yeah, I mean, and this, I'm in this situation myself, where my family is on the west coast of the island, San Sebastian. I haven't spoken to them in over a week. Haven't been able to get in touch. So it's very frustrating, I think, for many in the diaspora to see just the kind of more rural areas or areas far outside of San Juan are completely without communication and in a really dire situation. I think that the tendency is in these moments to focus on San Juan and recovery efforts there because it is the capital and because it's also a major tourist destination, right? So I think in terms of building up economic growth, people are very concerned with how fast can we get San Juan back up to speed and running and able to accept tourists. And I think that that's really that kind of myopic focus on the San Juan area is really going to hamper recovery efforts in other parts of Puerto Rico, in the island municipalities, which are even more cut off than in mainland Puerto Rican territories. There's really little focus on those areas. And I think that we also have to be aware in these recovery efforts that focus on the metro, San Juan metro area, also means that immigrant communities, poor communities, and communities of color, particularly black communities in Puerto Rico that are outside of the San Juan area, are going to get hit especially hard. And so those inequalities that already exist within Puerto Rican society are really going to be magnified. Getting to the other part of your question, I think that the point about distribution is really crucial. And that has to also do with the collapse in communication infrastructure that's occurred essentially outside, which is happening all over Puerto Rico, but is particularly acute outside of the metropolitan area of San Juan, where there is cargo in the ports that is just sitting there and has been sitting there for days because they can't get in contact with truck drivers to bring that stuff out to these other areas of the island to even load that cargo. And so I think that the priority really has to be in terms of being able to get necessary materials where they need to go in repairing that communication infrastructure as fast as possible.
I was going to ask about tourism. You touched on it from the perspective of people on the island now. If you start from the point that they're saying 3 to 6 months before the infrastructure, basic needs like power, are back online. But presumably it would be even longer than that before tourism can resume to a place where it's anywhere close to where it was before. Where are these people on the island who are in the service sector going to make a living in the next, for all of the other problems that they have just with basic turning on the light and there being a light, where are they making a buck if they were in the tourism industry?
Right. I think all of those people who were in the tourism industry might have to migrate, right? I think that it is going to be increasingly difficult to find employment unless you're in construction or transportation or any of these other essential fields that are going to play a role in the recovery efforts. I think that you're going to see a massive migration, and this has been a trend that we've been seeing in Puerto Rico as a result since 2008, but particularly increasing in the past 2 to 3 years because of the deepening of the debt crisis, where people just feel like they cannot get ahead. They're unable to find employment. The employment that they are able to find is usually low-wage employment in the service sector or in the tourism industry. And so to knock out that entire sector of the population, of the employment kind of pool, you're going to have a lot of exodus, I think, to places like Miami and other and Orlando and other kind of destinations for this new kind of Puerto Rican migration.
All right, I need to take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up. We have a wonderful panel this morning, including Professor Marisol Lebron, who is Associate Professor at Dickinson College and one of the co-founders of the Puerto Rico Syllabus Project. We will continue our conversation with our panel right after this. Good morning and welcome back to the program and our roundtable discussion. Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Vera Carius, Kelly, Teresa Bourgeois, and also joined by telephone, at least for the next few moments, with Professor Marisol LeBron, associate professor at Dickinson College. And the discussion we were just having, Marisol, during the break was, where is Dickinson? It's Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So it's outside of Harrisburg.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for being with us. Teresa, we'll get you in on this conversation.
Yeah, well, I two things that I'm wondering, get your thoughts on, that are unrelated. One is, what happens if there is this out-migration? How does that, what does that bode for the long-term health of the island, both in Puerto Rico and in the U.S. Virgin Islands? I've wondered about that. And the other unrelated, but I'll put them both on the table, is in Texas, and you know, Harvey and Irma, one of the things that the government did well is pre-position National Guard, they pre-positioned food, they pre-positioned water, but it doesn't appear that they pre-positioned those supplies and people. They didn't either in Puerto Rico or the U.S. Virgin Islands, and I wonder if there's any reason that you know of why that didn't happen?
Right, I think that's a really good question. I'll answer your last question first. In terms of that, that has been one of the central critiques of Puerto Ricans in the diaspora and those who have communication on the island, was this feeling that the government, both locally and federally, was just not prepared and did not take the appropriate steps to really prepare the population for the devastation that really they knew was going to happen. The reports of it being Category 5 and the scale, they knew it was going to cause massive damage. And so I think part of that, we see, again, an inequality between the U.S. and Puerto Rico. So, again, with Harvey, the Jones Act was lifted a week before to get essential, really a stock up of essential supplies into Texas, into South Texas. And we didn't see that with Puerto Rico, to the extent where the Jones Act was only lifted today and is only lifted for 10 days. So I think that there's that kind of element of inequality. In terms of what was happening with the local government, I think that it coming right on the heels of Hurricane Irma also really knocked out their ability to appropriately prepare for a natural disaster of this scale. I think they were trying to respond, even though Irma only grazed the island in a sense, it did cause massive disruptions to the power grid, to communications. People did lose their homes. So they were really dealing, I think, with the aftermath of Irma, and right immediately after that, we got hit with Maria. So I think that explains some of this kind of ill-preparedness on the part of the local government. In terms of your other question, I think that question of what are the long-term effects of this kind of out-migration are really crucial, and I'm so glad that you brought up the U.S. Virgin Islands, because they are also in a similar position where they were completely devastated by both Irma and Maria, and their tourism sector is completely wiped out. And the U.S. Virgin Islands, although it doesn't get as much press, actually is in as much debt as Puerto Rico, has double the unemployment rate as the mainland U.S. So they're in a very similar kind of dire economic situation as Puerto Rico, and I think that's telling that the U.S. territories that are not states are experiencing this kind of economic distress. So I think you're going to see massive migration from the U.S. Virgin Islands as well as from Puerto Rico, and what that is going to do is really hamper some of the local rebuilding that needs to happen in order to create a sustainable economy in those sites and kind of long-term locally kind of backed and driven economic growth.
All right, we have time for one more question. Alan, you want first dibs or?
No, I'm delighted with the professor's insights into the way in all of this is working. We had one letter, Joe, that said, what if all the Puerto Rican folks who are in such trouble right now moved to Florida and could balance that equation out in favor of the Democrats? Would, in fact, that make a difference?
I mean, I think this is the the worry about this, basically the island getting emptied out and ending up in Florida. And, you know, I think I want to caution people against that thinking, because I think what gets lost in that, right, is it becomes a kind of game of electoral politics, right, is who will they vote for and how will that then alter things. And I think that what gets lost in that is really the fact that this is a migration that is essentially forced, right? That people are left with so few options for living on the island, that whether they want to migrate or not, they feel that migration is the only option. And I think that that is a kind of act of cruelty, in a sense, not to sound overly dramatic, but I think that when we talk about people having the right to live where they want to live and have freedom to kind of prosper in their homes, right, we need to ensure that ability. And right now, the steps that the government is taking, and I think their reliance on the fact that they can kind of kick their heels up because these are U.S. citizens who can just migrate and enter into kind of the low-wage pool of workers in the U.S., is really hampering people's ability to make the life they want where they want to live it.
Well, I know you have. Okay, Joe, I'm sorry.
Well, we have a break, and I know. So, Marisol, what is your timing? Do you have to leave us now, or do you have a few more moments?
I can stick around.
Okay, great. So we're going to hold you, if that's okay. We're going to go to news, and when we come back, I know Vera has a question, Teresa has a question, and then we'll start because we have a ton of letters as well, and then we'll move on. But thank you very much for holding. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable panel. We are talking about Puerto Rico for a good section of our discussion this morning. Alan Chartok is here, Ira Fussfeld, Professor Vera Acarias-Kelly. We also welcome Teresa Bourgeois. And our guest for a few more moments on the phone is Professor Marisol Lebrun, who is Associate Professor at Dickinson College and co-founder of the Puerto Rico Syllabus Project. Before we get back into the conversation, and I know our panel has a lot of questions, I just want to note that if you go to the WAMC website, WAMC.org, there is a support tab. And if you click support, you will see a link there to help the people of Puerto Rico. We have a bunch of links up from One America Appeal, UNICEF, Global Giving, United for Puerto Rico, and some of the organizations that we've identified that you can help and choose. And people have been asking us, so it is there. And we hope you can do whatever possible. Vera, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, Marisol. Of course, we're listening to you. Your last remarks were on the rights of course, Puerto Ricans wanting to live where they grew up. This is their home. Same in the Virgin Islands. People feel really strongly about having opportunities in their home towns and home country, home area. And here we are, over 50% of U.S. citizens not knowing that Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands are part of the United States. What are the chances, you think, that a major long-term investment plan will emerge from this administration to rebuild Puerto Rico, to assist people long-term in the Virgin Islands, to actually allow that to happen, for people to rebuild their lives?
I mean, unfortunately, I think it's unlikely within the current political climate and context. I think that the emphasis right now really is on, for at least Puerto Rico, servicing the debt. And I think we need to be really, really paying attention over the next couple of weeks and months about what happens in the U.S. Virgin Islands, because there is fear of economic collapse there and of a similar bankruptcy kind of process needing to happen in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And the question becomes, how is the U.S. going going to deal with that? And what do they feel their responsibility is? I think that a lot of the rhetoric, particularly around, which is disturbing, particularly around the recovery and Puerto Rican's deservingness of U.S. aid, is that the kind of excuses being used to withhold aid are they can't even handle their own finances because look at the mess they made. They're $72 billion in debt, right? And I think there is no knowledge among the American public of how that debt was generated, the fact that it is believed that a large portion of that debt was illegally generated through usurious terms and these vulture hedge funds, and that there has been requests from Puerto Rican civil society to audit the debt, and that it has repeatedly been denied, that people know what exactly that $72 billion paid for, or what it, or if it's all just fees, right? There's a lot of it is really just kind of usurious fees on the debt. So I think that these are, so that's one thing, one excuse that's getting mobilized is that really this paternalistic colonial discourse that Puerto Ricans can't administer their own finances, and they surely should not be in charge of their own kind of economic recovery because they just, they're wasteful, they're inept, they're ignorant. The other kind of excuse that's getting used is really also about, well, if Puerto Rico wanted to be a state, it had plenty of chances, and they didn't, and so this is what they get. Because if they were a state, they would have full access to recovery aid. And that, again, is not true for the reasons that we just discussed regarding the plebiscite and how the U.S. has kind of stuck its hands into Puerto Rican's decisions about its future. So I think that these are excuses that really the majority of the U.S. public is getting a very short-sighted understanding of the political and economic landscape in places like Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, and really recycling these very, very old colonial tropes about really the ignorant natives, right, that need U.S. intervention or don't deserve it.
I have a separate question, but you do pay the people of Puerto Rico, they pay, you can speak to this better, Social Security, Medicare, such, right? I mean, they...
Right. They pay into all of those funds. And so I think that's also another thing that people often criticize Puerto Ricans about is that they're seen as kind of parasites upon the U.S. kind of economy and particularly again, in terms of social services, right? So Puerto Ricans withdraw from Social Security, withdraw from certain kind of retirement funds, have access, although not equally, have access to food stamps and other kinds of social safety net economic programs. And so this also becomes another part of the rhetoric is that Puerto Ricans are just there to take, and there's no acknowledgement of the ways in which really the U.S. benefits immensely in economic terms from keeping Puerto Rico as a commonwealth, from keeping the Jones Act in place. Puerto Rico really acts as a captive economic population. There's more Walgreens and Walmarts per capita in Puerto Rico than there are anywhere else under U.S. jurisdiction, and those tend to be the most profitable stores.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to Puerto Rico, there's nothing essentially but U.S. chain stores, and really the local Puerto Rican economy has been eliminated in a sense. Not. I mean, that's overstating it, but it is very, very difficult for local folks who want to open businesses to be able to stake their claim, right, and to be able to compete. And I think one of the most tragic things that we are going to see happening post Maria is really that the Puerto Rico's burgeoning local agriculture, which Puerto Rico is a place that imports 85% of its food, despite the fact that it has extremely fertile lands, right? imports most of his food from the U.S. and from other neighboring countries in the Caribbean. And there had been a renaissance in response to the crisis of local agriculture, where people were trying to go back to the land, to live sustainably, and to really create this sector where there wasn't a reliance on import, where people could have more access to fresh and more affordable food. And Puerto Rico's agricultural sector has been decimated, and there's questions about how it will recover. And unfortunately, that was a kind of bright spot for the local economy, and for kind of people trying to figure out how to build a local sustainable economy, and it's been just devastated.
Professor Marisol Lebron teaches American Studies at Dickinson College, co-founder of the Puerto Rico Syllabus Project. Professor Lebron, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning. A great pleasure to have your insights.
Thank you for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Not surprisingly, we have a lot of letters on the subject. We'll try to get to as many as we can and hear from the other members of our panel as well. Asa says, I saw a theory that real estate / resort investors are waiting to swoop in when people are forced to move out to snap up gorgeous properties for pennies on the dollar. Any thoughts on any ways to prevent this?
Does he think Trump is going to do it?
Well, actually, there's
that's
an interesting
the implication. Yeah.
There's the story about the Trump golf course where he left them with a $33 million, bond that wasn't paid for. So he's already been there and caused problems. So we'll see.
Wesley writes, let the citizens move to Florida and turn that state blue and see if Trump and his fellow Republicans care about them then. Jill says the fact that Puerto Rico is a blue state may be a factor for the poor response, but I think it's more because it's majority Hispanic, and we already know how the Republicans feel about Hispanic peoples. And let me see. One more here. Great. Ken says, do you think Trump knew that the people of Puerto Rico are citizens? We've had a lot of this on both the Virgin Islands as Puerto Rico.
No. I doubt it. I mean, survey after survey shows that, the majority of U.S. citizens have no idea about who people are in Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, or Guam, or any of these territories.
You go back to that last question. Katrina was an albatross for Bush. One could have alleged that Bush approached Katrina the same way that Trump is approaching Puerto Rico. That is to say, he's not interested in it because of the makeup of the population. But the fact is, it was a bad deal for Bush, and it saddled his administration. And if Trump is doing it, for whatever reason, Trump is not paying as much attention to this as he should, it is going to follow him around, whether or not it's a blue state or a blue territory or a red territory. So he's either getting awful advice or he is following his instinct, as he says he often does, and his instinct is not very good. There is no upside to him, politically or otherwise, to treat Puerto Rico at arm's length.
But I also think, and we spoke about this yesterday, as he abdicates leadership, other people are stepping in. You see Michael Bloomberg and other private sector folks, and it'll be interesting to see. I know, my friend and a friend of the show, Judith Inc., is going down to the U.S. Virgin Islands to work with the governor there on trying to be, when they rebuild in a more sustainable, resilient way, thinking about green technology options and such. And one only hopes, you had Michael Bloomberg on the Stephen Colbert show last night talking about this, trying to draw attention. You see Barack Obama, former President Obama, President Clinton, in the last few days trying to draw some attention with their, Presidential United Fund. And one hopes that, per the question, the letter writer who said, are we going to have all of the folks just come in and resort folks sweep up the island? You hope that there's some help in building these places back in a way that is more sustainable, that does support local farming, that does take advantage of solar and wind and such. But it's going to require a lot of help.
And long-term investment, not just a quick Band-Aid.
And visionary.
Help in and then out, and people somehow come back on their own.
All right, let's go to some other topics in just a few minutes that we have left. And we've been talking a lot about, obviously, a lot about this issue. And we have we welcome your letters. It's panel at WAMC.org. I do want to just go to another topic that we talked about yesterday. And, Alan, we'll start with you about Alabama and the article this morning in the Washington Post that says Alabama defeat leaves Trump weakened, isolated amid mounting challenges. That the reports are that he is very upset, was fuming, feeling dragged along by GOP senators who had pleaded with him to go, and increasingly unenthusiastic about Strange, whom he described to aides as loyal but low energy. We know how the president feels about low energy. So does he have a right to be upset about this? And what does ultimately the rise of Roy Moore mean for the Republican Party, I guess?
Well, it's a disaster. I can tell you the Democrats are going to make out as a result of this, because it's going to cause dissension within the Republican Party. We know that. There are the regular Republicans, the Bushian Republicans, and then there are these guys who just are feeding more red meat to the designated catchers than are the regular Republicans or Donald Trump. So it is a bad piece of news for Trump. He says, I made a mistake. I endorsed the wrong guy. Yeah, he made a mistake. He thought he could turn it around. He would have gotten tremendous pressure out of this. Look, Murray the dog doesn't like it. I don't like it. and all I'm saying here is that this is something that they didn't count on, is one more problem, because this guy is going to be around for at least 6 years more, and unless he really screws it up, which, by the way, he has done in the past when he was Chief Justice on his state court and the rest. So I'm just saying it's a disaster for the Republican Party.
But a Republican senator is going to go and support, you know, how are they going to respond to the question of it? Moore said things like he talks about red, brown, yellow, black and white people. Right. That's how he describes people. He said that 9/11 was, quote, because we've distanced ourselves from God. That's why he said 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
It goes on and on and on, some of the things that he said. And so, our Republican senators, the GOP, they're going to stand behind this guy and his statements?
Well, what are they doing with it?
The problem here is, what are their choices? They can do what's right. They've always had that option. Or they can be in a position where they say, I don't want a primary, so I'm going to support him.
And can the Democrats afford to sit this one out? You know, I realize that Doug Jones is a long shot, but I just think you cannot let this go.
Well, there are times to shut up and there are times not to. Your assessment, and you and I have been in touch on email during the night on this one, and that is
okay. Well,
there's a political article.
Yeah, Joe and I were Joe and I were writing about you.
Yeah, no. Look, there are times to keep your mouth shut and let them destroy each other. On the other hand, Teresa has some evidence that the Democratic candidate, who is a former U.S. attorney and who has done remarkable things, but who is way, way, way behind in the polls, can win here. And there's a possibility that that's true if, in fact, what ends up happening is that you have a divided Republican Party who either sit on their hands in the general election or who vote for the Democrat just to say, I'll get even with you. If that happens, you get a chance. But right now, the polling is showing dismal for the Democrats. Mm.
But even if he doesn't win, I think you have to hold your elected members accountable to say, do you support this guy? Do the Republicans support somebody who calls people, you know, yellow people and
But in the red states, there is evidence of such dissatisfaction with McConnell and the so-called moderate Republicans. We might not call them moderates, but that's what they appear to be versus this guy, that there are going to be more Roy Moores out there, more of them backed by Breitbart, and that they may well help the Republicans keep the majority in the House and the Senate, but a different kind of, a more radicalized Republican, and then what? I mean, it seems to me that could accrue negatively to the Republicans in 2020.
Oh, for sure.
But 2018, yeah. They could do a lot of damage in this country if they control the House, farther right than what we currently have.
That's why I also agree with you, Teresa, that it is important to point out whenever Roy Moore and those kinds of people say horrific things about minorities, about religious communities that aren't his faith, don't fall into his faith tradition. I mean, it is truly essential for Democrats to speak out on that issue, just to hold the line on what are human rights and social justice questions.
Or as Trump would say, Ray Moore.
And Flanagan. We are out of time, but my thanks to everybody for joining us. Alan, thank you. Ira,
thank you.
Vera, and Teresa, thank
you. Go to WAMC and donate to Puerto Rico.
Support Puerto Rico and help and do whatever you can. We would love for you to do that. Also, don't forget panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.